What a lot of people have thought it was. So you ask yourself the question, well, why are scientists being attacked? Most scientists want to be apolitical. Most scientists are not environmental activists. And one of the things we showed in that book was that the vast majority of the scientists who had worked on these problems had come across them by accident. They were not environmentalists who said, I want to study acid rain. They were forest ecologists who stumbled on acid rain, who discovered the damage that was happening to trees from acid rain. So these were scientists doing science, but what did they discover? They discovered market failure. They discovered these very, very serious problems being created by the free market system that the free market system didn't seem to have a solution for.
That is the author of Merchants of Doubt, Naomi Oreskes, interviewed for a whole hour on Letters in Politics, which you can find through the KPFA archives. Letters in Politics has a Facebook presence, but I don't think it's quite active. Thanks for listening. It's 11 o'clock. Straight Up opinions are those of the speakers, not necessarily shared by others at the station. And it's time for the Labor Hour.
Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on the air by listener-supported community radio station WEFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. And the views and opinions you're going to be hearing are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the station manager, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now here's Bob with some underwriting announcements.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, give them a call at 217-328-2295. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And programming on the World Labor Hour is supported in part by listeners of WEFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour.
Okay, thank you, Bob. I just got back from a trip down south, and part of the trip was in Memphis, Tennessee, and went to the old Lorraine Motel where Dr. Martin Luther King was murdered. It's now the Civil Rights Museum. And just want to say, if anybody gets a chance to get down to Memphis, I highly recommend you check out the Civil Rights Museum. It's just simply incredible. I mean, it blew me away. Anyway, it was also in New Orleans, and it was interesting. There's still parts of the city where you can see markings from Hurricane Katrina, the X's they put on the buildings, and the numbers indicating number of people alive, number of people dead. And speaking of which, as usual, we're going to be doing a show, a commemoration about Hurricane Katrina coming up here in late part of August, because this is something that we should never forget about the tragedy that happened and the failure other things that horrible things that happened during Katrina. So anyway, we're going to be having a guest call in at half past the hour, Mark Dudzik. He's the national coordinator of the Labor for Single Payer campaign. So in the meantime, we'll talk a little bit about some news stories, starting with Bob.
All right, Dave. A bruising four-month fight between the Healthcare Workers Union 1199 of the SEIU, United Healthcare Workers East, and John Hopkins Hospital is coming to an end. Members voted on Thursday and Friday to ratify a new agreement covering about 2,000 medical center employees. The battle has been unusually intense compared with negotiations in the past, featuring a three-day strike in April and a voracious media campaign shaming the wealthy hospital for abandoning its lowest-paid workers. And though the new contract falls short of initial demands that would have more widely boosted wages among staff, Local 1199 of the SEIU leaders still view its ratification as a welcome victory after months of struggle. According to the John Reed, the executive vice president of 1199, he says it was a tough negotiation. They are hard bargainers. He says they act as if they have no respect for their own workforce. The contract calls for an across-the-board wage increases of 2% a year in each of the first 3 years, followed by a 2.75% increase in 2017. In addition, it calls for a 0.5% salary bonus in the first year. So what they did, what they wanted to compare and contrast, they say in order to garner support from other workers and the Baltimore public, during its campaign, the union contrasted the modest incomes of maintenance and food service staff at the hospital with the lavish compensation arrangements for the facility's senior administrators. Mm-hmm. For example, according to an 1199 analysis of public documents, Hopkins President Ronald Peterson was the highest-paid hospital executive in the state in 2012, and Internal Revenue Service records showed that the next year he received a $1.2 million salary, plus a bonus of $455,000, and a one-time $11.9 million pension benefit.
Oh, wow.
Based on his 40 years of service with the hospital. So these folks initially were just trying to get a minimum $15 an hour But most of these people will at least get increased about $13 an hour. So
okay,
somewhat of a victory for those folks there.
Yes, indeed. Okay, what else do you have for us, Bob?
There's a labor dispute going on in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania with American Water Company.
Yeah.
And the utility workers in Pittsburgh have been forced onto the picket lines by what they're calling illegal conduct by Pennsylvania-American Water and its New Jersey-based parent company, American Water Company.
Which is a German-owned multinational.
Yes, and has subsidiaries in almost every state in the union. I mean, they control our water here.
Yep.
They're Illinois American Water here locally.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a series of NLRB rulings against American Water in October of 2012. An administrative law judge for the NLRB ruled that American Water illegally slashed health care and other benefits for 3,500 utility workers in Pittsburgh. In June of 2013, the NLRB issued an order finding that Pennsylvania American Water threatened employees in Pittsburgh and other work sites across Pennsylvania with illegal retaliation if they exercised rights protected by federal labor law. In May of 2014, Pennsylvania American and American Water settled a nationwide complaint issued by the NLRB against the company's adoption of an illegal rule restricting employees' rights. And again, on June 9th of 2014, Pennsylvania American Water illegally implemented cutbacks in Pittsburgh employees' existing terms of employment without bargaining in good faith. They have been without a contract there since May of 2011.
What?
Yes.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So, ridiculous. And now, apparently, there's been a rash of opened fire hydrants around the area. And so, Illinois or Pennsylvania American Water is blaming that on the union, and the union says they got nothing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been a contentious fight here for quite some time. Obviously, if this goes on since 2011, over 3 years they've been working without a contract there,
mm-hmm.
and a series of NLRB rulings against the company.
Yes. Just another reason why communities should own their own water. I've heard about American Water fighting, various communities that wanted to go to a public community-controlled water arrangement, and I think it's up in Naperville or Aurora, I think, and also a couple over in Indiana, and American Water is basically, just arrogantly stated, we'll go take us to court and we'll bankrupt your communities. I mean, they're horrible. And,
ridiculous.
And, a community needs to control their water supply, because otherwise, when you have private corporations controlling it, you have no or very, very little control over what they do with that water as far as potentially, shipping it out to where they can get top dollar for it in other parts of the country or the world, arbitrarily raising your rates. And now, how they treat their employees,
Right, right. Yeah. That's a local 537 there of the Utility Workers Union of America, UWUA.
Okay.
That's local 537. No, I hadn't heard of it either till this story, the UWUA, Utility Workers Union of America.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was listening to on my headphones to Representative Gohmert being an idiot about food stamps.
Representative Gohmert?
Yeah, was he from Texas or somewhere, one of those crazy Republicans.
Phil Gohmert or whatever.
Gohmert.
Gohmert.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Is the local American Water Company, is it union?
Yes.
Okay. What union represents now?
I believe it's that National
that
Utility
same
Workers,
one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not 100% certain on that, but I do know they're unionized.
Okay.
And, also besides water, I mean, like the Springfield, Illinois, and Rantoul, Illinois actually has their own city-controlled electricity.
Power company.
Power company,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Springfield has some of the lowest rates in the state.
Now, see, BMint, and I've thought about maybe applying for a job with this company.
Mm-hmm.
They have a company called ERH
mm-hmm.
that's based, I think, somewhere around Danville, maybe Westville. And it used to be they had one guy,
mm-hmm.
Bob.
Oh, really?
a different Bob, not this Bob. And he took care of all the sewer and water. And in the summer, they'd hire some high school kid to help him or
mm-hmm.
something.
Yeah.
And so now they have this thing where they're paying this company over $300,000 a year.
I bet Bob wasn't getting that much money.
No.
No.
And
I know Bob.
Yeah, they're paying this company $300,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to do something that they probably spent, I don't know, $100,000 a year.
Yeah, probably
on,
at most.
You know, Bob would have had a halfway decent middle income and
pension
insurance and such. Now I was looking at it like, well, let's say, okay, they cover like several towns in the area and they use one backhoe instead of every town buying a backhoe.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It just doesn't seem like
This is the whole myth and lie
about privatization. Somehow it's going to be cheaper.
It's going to be cheaper and more efficient. And that's just it's just the opposite of the case. It's more expensive because you have boards of directors, you have shareholders, profit takers, and all that.
I mean,
you know, it's like, and there's just some things, you know, that needs to be community and / public controlled, you know, water, utilities. I definitely, in my opinion, should be. That's definitely one of the should be's, as well as health care, by the way, which is.
Well, perhaps maybe the necessities of life, and it's sort of like what they say about the military, that a war is too important for generals. Perhaps all these necessities of life are too important for business people to run.
Well, yeah, I would agree with that. You know, not to mention it's going to be cheaper and better, you know. And the ultimate thing is, of course, the control by the community, you know.
Yeah. Now, Monticello goes the opposite direction. They bought a big track hoe a few years ago. I mean, they're doing stuff, more stuff than, say, like the U of I or Champaign or Urbana does, I mean, construction-wise. And they're scabbing on us, you know.
Well, yeah, you're going to get into those.
Well, they are. They're not doing it union. I wouldn't mind it at all if they'd sign contracts with the AGs, you know, the unions.
Yes.
And call the appropriate union halls when they need the extra help. But they don't do that. Instead, they hire somebody's, you know, college kid, you know, somebody's college kid to do my work, you know, in the summer.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to take a quick music break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be back soon. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. That was Ann Feeney with National Healthcare Now, which I thought I'd play since it's going to be relevant to our topic today. That's going to be being talked about from our call-in guest and everything. So, but anyway, we have a special guest in the studio today too. Who wants to remain anonymous. His first name Steve, and during the music break, you know, on the subject of public and privatized water, utilities in general, water in particular, was a case of Bolivia back in the, I believe it was the late 90s, early 2000s, where the government of Bolivia signed a contract with Bechtel Corporation, totally privatized their entire water system, and Bechtel came in and, like, raised water rates, like, tenfold, and also in the contract included that people could be fined for collecting rainwater if they didn't pay a royalty fee every month to Bechtel. I mean, think about that, collecting rainwater. And people who had their own wells, some of these wells go back, you know, hundreds, if not maybe even a thousand years or more, have been, you know, owned by the family, you know, or probably most of that time anyway, were getting taxed and fees that hadn't been paid for their own wells. And this precipitated a revolution, actually, in the country. Right. I mean, it was peaceful as much as possible, but, I mean, the military and the police killed a lot of people because they were blocking highways. And it finally came to the point where so many people got involved, and a lot of these Bolivian miners came down from the mountains with dynamite, throwing it at riot police and stuff. And that finally the president had to flee the country. And, you know, then shortly after that, Evo Morales was elected by a huge majority of the people, and they threw Bechtel Corporation out of the country.
Yeah.
But that's the potential you have, see? I mean, it's the privatized water company could potentially raise your water rates, or if it's electric utility, your electricity rates tenfold overnight if they chose to, and, you know, you know, horrible things like, you know, with water, you know, taxing you or fining you for collecting rainwater, use your own well. I mean, so this is why communities need to control their own utilities, especially water. And water is going to become more and more a precious commodity as time goes on here.
Or as you've been mentioning with the TPP, these corporations have the ability to sue for potential loss of profits.
Yes, which is ridiculous.
Well, and there's all kinds of schemes of wanting to, like, you know, transport Great Lakes water, you know, and things like that. Which,
tow an iceberg.
Well, yeah, that'll be easier as time goes on. But, but so I think a real important message on this, too, is the will of the people.
Indeed.
Once it got to the point where their backs were that far against the wall. You know, I mean, the change to Evo Morales was a gigantic. I mean, it's truly revolutionary from what was obviously a corrupt, you know, regime that made this deal with Bechtel.
Yes.
And I think also that's why you have liberal Supreme Courts in the United States and non-liberal Supreme Courts. If you look back at the social atmosphere when a lot of that stuff was going on and compare it to now and recent decisions in the Supreme Court, it just shows me that it's what's going on in the larger society and the greater attitudes of the people and their activity. You know.
Yeah, I'm reading an interesting book now that's kind of related to that. It's called All the President's Bankers. And Naomi Prince, and she used to work on Wall Street, and she's very knowledgeable.
Right.
She was on Democracy Now! And a lot of other stations during right after the 2008 financial collapse. And
now, is this her novel?
It's a book, actually. It's not a novel. It's an actual.
Oh, okay. Because I think she's written a novel.
She's written a novel.
Too.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, before this book, and this is all factual, very well researched. It starts back in with Teddy Roosevelt.
That would be a good
up to present time and. Unbelievable how much power the banks have had, even going all the way back. And Teddy Roosevelt got elected on an anti-banking,
a progressive.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what's interesting is that even though he ran that platform against the, you know, robber barons and stuff, that shortly after getting in office, you know, he started to realize that how much power these bankers had, you know, the J.P. Morgan and some of these other people. And what's real interesting is I'm not only up to about the towards the end of the Second World War right now, where Roosevelt dies and Truman's just coming in. But what's really interesting is a small little boutique financial services company that no one ever heard of, called Goldman Sachs at the time in the early 30s, started becoming. That was sort of their foot in the door when they started to grow, is when Roosevelt first came in, because they got back, they backed his campaign and all that, and which also shows you, I mean, just going back, why we need public financed elections, because, you know, even back then, going back to Teddy Roosevelt, they needed money to run campaigns for president, you know, even though they didn't have television.
Well, even beyond that, I think we really need to move to a parliamentary form of government. I mean, I know it has its faults too, but I would like to see more than one party have any kind of say.
Yes. Because we sort of have a winner-take-all kind of system.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, and the thing is, you can't get any, even if you cannot get a large number, you know, even if you have minor parties that can't get a majority or something on their own, they're still in there debating, they're still having influence, and their views will be seen as at least nominally legitimate compared to people that are frozen outside.
Yes.
But on the other hand, electoral politics can be very co-opting, but I think in that type of situation,
yes,
it's
indeed
better.
Okay, we're waiting for our guest to call in, so we'll take another music break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to World Labor Hour on WFT Radio, a listeners' support community radio station in Champaign, Illinois.
Get up, stand up,
get up, stand up,
stand up for your right.
Get up.
Hey, that was Bob Marley. Get up, stand up for your rights. And, you know, this is a I'm trying to sort of play in a certain theme here today, and because our main guest is going to be calling in here pretty soon, is going to be talking about the need for single-payer Medicare for All health care. I mean, folks, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, it just hasn't done what needs to be done. I mean, we can get into a debate about whether or not, you know, how effective it is. I mean, it has helped some people. I mean, probably a very small minority, and given the illusion that it's helped the problem, but the real solution, the real proven solution, going back in some countries over 100 years, is Medicare single-payer health care. Because like we were talking about water and utilities, when you have private interest controlling anything like your health care, I mean, basic needs, as Bill said, and health care is definitely a very basic human need.
These things, not just if it's a need, it's a right. That's what I'm going to say. If you need it, you have a right to it.
Yeah. Food, water, housing, healthcare, and you could even say education, too, you know.
Yes.
Otherwise, there is no right to life at all, period.
Yes, indeed.
Any type of right to life.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of
people... To use a much abused phrase.
Yes. And, you know, the thing is, I guess the luck, if you will, being married to a woman who from Germany originally, who's still a German national, and you know, I had the opportunity to, shortly after we were married in the late 70s, to go to Germany.
Yeah, I dig those sexy accents.
And talk with you know, her friends and relatives there about, you know, what they had, you know, as far as medical care and other things. And it's just, I mean, it's hard to, you know, I came back and told people a lot of this stuff back in the late 70s, and they found it hard to believe. I mean, but it's true. I mean, you know, nobody goes without health care there. Nobody loses their home because of health care bills, and no one dies needlessly like here in the United States. I mean, there's close to 50,000 people who die every year because of treatable things that they're unable to get access to the health care they need.
Okay, Dave, I want to bring something up from an off-air caller.
Yes.
Midwatch Stan, who's on Wednesday night.
Yes, hi, Stan.
He called in and you know, asked us if we'd mention anything about Bernie Sanders running for president.
Uh-huh.
Bernie Sanders, who would support a much better health care system than we have right now.
He's a co-author of the Sanders-McDermott bill for single-payer health care in the Senate. It's the kind of the companion bill that's in the House that's was originally sponsored by John Conyers and Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah, and anyway, Stan sees Bernie Sanders as sort of analogous to the Tea Party in the with the Republicans, where Sanders would push the Democrats more to the left, mm-hmm. hopefully in the same manner that the Tea Party folks seem to be pushing the Republicans more to the right. And we were in a little argument about this. I'm sort of like, well, man, I don't, you know, the establishment Republicans, you can't get much farther right than that. You know, I mean, it's just that the Tea Party people have such a style, I think, is more about it.
Mm-hmm.
They would vote the same way on any issue.
Here's the thing about Medicare for All single payer.
Yeah, there is no moderate Republican.
Well, the thing is, this is an issue. This is one of several issues that has the potential to transcend all this identity politics, to transcend all this party politics. Because I don't, you know, there's a lot of working people out there who do vote Republican, okay, or who don't vote at all. But nevertheless, I mean, you know, ask them about, you know, if they want to give up their Social Security, are you, you know, that's coming up, you know, for themselves or what their older relatives might currently have. No way. Okay, and all these people out there, these working people who do vote Republican, they have health care problems just like anyone else. This is an issue that transcends, because the polls have shown, I mean, it depends on which poll and what point in time it was taken and how the poll was worded, but it's been consistently anywhere from 55 to 72% of the American people polled support a single-payer Medicare for All system. So why don't we have it? Just like in the Democratic debates in 2008 when one of the people in the audience point blank to ask Hillary Clinton about single payer. She goes, yes, yes, I know you all, I know it's very popular and everything, but it's not politically
feasible.
Feasible, yes. Well, what's that mean, Hillary?
Dave, don't forget, you live in a republic, not a democracy.
Well, we'll get into that in another program, maybe.
I bet I'd get so sick of hearing that crap from right-wingers.
But the point is that when Hillary Clinton says it's not politically possible, what she's saying is that... their corporate donors don't want it.
Well, and the establishment doesn't want it, which is the corporate donors, you know,
control
the wealthy
government.
People.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, you know, the corporate...
bankers don't want it.
Yeah. Yes. You know, even though it's ironic that a lot of companies, you know, American corporations, could really benefit from it, you know,
that
because
is
healthcare
correct.
Costs eat up a huge amount of their, you know, labor costs.
I bet Ford made more money on my 1998 F-150... because it was made in Windsor, Ontario.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and they didn't have the health care costs. Or the legacy, what they call legacy health care costs. In other words, paying the health care costs of people that have retired. You know, I got a friend of ours, you know him, I won't mention his name on air, but he's a fellow carpenter. His father worked at the UAW Caterpillar plant in Decatur for many, many years, retired about, I guess, 30 years ago or so. No, 20 years ago, maybe. And he passed away quite a few years ago. But his wife, my friend's mother, who's 93 years old, still gets the UAW health care. It pays 100% of all her health care medication.
Yeah. Well, here's another one, Dave. They had their, I don't know if it's like this now, but I do remember in the 80s, their workers' compensation would pay for non-job related accidents.
Really?
Yeah, you would get 60, no, wait a minute, it was 80% back then, too. This one friend of mine, he would, I mean, it seemed like he had a cast on all the time. And then they'd pay, he also had this ashtray.
Uh-huh.
He goes, see that ashtray? I said, yeah. He goes, I made that in the nut house. I said, what? And he goes, well, you know, Caterpillar, they paid me to go down to St. Louis and dry out.
Oh, wow.
And I made that there. And he goes, but I left when they shut off the downers.
Oh, my gosh.
But, I mean, you know, they just had their system. I'm sure they don't have that now with all the cutbacks they've had. That I'm sure that went long before they imposed a two-tier mm-hmm. wage system.
Yeah, you know, what I was talking about Hillary Clinton earlier is what's interesting is that she's saying, I don't want, you know, really what her statement is, it's not politically feasible, is I don't want to work on it for you. You know, I don't want to work on getting real health care reform for you. You know, and that's what she means by politically not possible. And but you know what's interesting? My wife works in a public school, and one of the teachers, we were talking about health care one time, she says, you know what, when the next U.S. congressman or senator comes for a town hall meeting, you know, and those are becoming fewer and fewer anymore, it seems, we need to say, all of us need to stand up and say, we want the same health care you have. Because members of Congress and the executive branch, they actually have a choice of either going to the VA hospitals or they can get a private policy of their choosing. And, you know, they got Medicare for all if they choose. They got three choices there on health care. But they basically have a Medicare for all system for the rest of their lives, not just while they're in Congress, but even after they retire.
Yeah.
You know, so we want what you have, congressmen, senators. I mean, this is the hypocrisy here. You know, they talk, you know, all the corporate media, you know, all the propaganda. I mean, my wife just loves, you know, not really, she hates it, hearing all this, you know, disinformation, propaganda about how horrible supposedly Medicare for all single payer health care is in other countries like Canada and Europe. You know, it's funny because when she's talking to somebody about it and they're just basically parroting back the lies they've heard in the corporate media, her favorite line is, well, have you ever lived under a Medicare single payer health care system?
No.
Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Mark Dudzik. I'm the National Coordinator for the Labor Campaign for Single Payer.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the World Labor Hour. I just want to let our listeners know that I actually, I've known about Mark for a couple years now, but I actually got to meet him face-to-face up at Labor Notes.
You know, I believe I've seen that name, Dudzik, on several articles over the years.
Mark's has got an interesting history. You know, could you tell us a little bit about yourself, Mark? Just a quick little, you know, bio, if you will.
Well, yeah, sure, Dave. You know, I joined the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union way back in 1979. I was in a organizing drive in a precious metals refinery in New Jersey. And then a few years later became the president of my local union. And I worked with a guy named Tony Mazzocchi for a lot of years.
Oh, yeah.
In my union. Tony was just a visionary labor leader. He was the guy who was probably most responsible for getting the Occupational Health and Safety Act passed in 1970 and kind of built some of the first labor and environmental alliances, you know, really understood that labor's biggest job was to lead a fight against corporate power and helped launch an effort to try to build a labor party in the 1990s. And I worked with my brother Tony on a lot of these things. I became a district council president in the old OCAW, which eventually merged into the Steelworkers a few years back.
Mm-hmm.
When Tony died in 2002, I came down to Washington, D.C. to work on a lot of his crazy dreams, including trying to see if we could keep this Labor Party effort alive, which we eventually had to put on the shelf, but some of the projects that we started in the Labor Party continued, including the fight for single-payer health care. So over the last few years, that evolved into a new organization, which we launched in 2009, called the Labor Campaign for Single-Payer Health Care. And our mission is to really move labor into leading the fight for health care justice
okay.
in the U.S.
Well, hasn't the Affordable Care Act taken care of all of our health care problems in the United States?
Well, in your dreams,
it might. Well, the Affordable Care Act didn't pay for my insurance that a contractor stiffed me on last year.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing. You know, that's a good point. Maybe you could explain a little bit about, because we've been hearing a lot of information on this, but, it's not real clear to myself and other people is just what kind of effect the Affordable Care Act has on union health plans.
There's a lot of good to be said about the Affordable Care Act. It does provide more access to health care. It will provide more insurance for, a lot of working poor folks who don't have health care. At best, it establishes a right to purchase health insurance, which is not a right to health care.
Good distinction, yes.
Yeah, really.
People are finding that out, and when, the bills come due and, the networks are set up and all of these other stresses that, happen in a private, for-profit, insurance-driven healthcare industry. It doesn't change the fundamental rules of the game. And then for union folks and other people who have enjoyed fairly decent employment-based health coverage, it actually makes things worse in a number of ways, and it's creating new stresses. And, it's not completely responsible for that. There's been a push for, decades now for employers to shift the costs of health care from their side onto the backs of the workers and their families.
Mm-hmm.
But it really accelerates that in a number of ways. So it's creating a whole new set of crises within labor and new pressures on bargaining for health care.
And how is that happening? I mean, it's my understanding that basically union health care plans will be taxed at ever-increasing rates over time?
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of different things, and it gets really complex because this bill, by trying to put the round peg of health care into the square peg of this for-profit system is incredibly confusing and complex and convoluted and changes all the time, and I don't think there's anybody who completely understands it. But there's a few areas that are pretty clear that are affecting union workers and then union health plans in particular. The first is, what I would call sort of an increase of race to the bottom pressures, just pushing cuts in benefits and pushing things downward, and it does that by setting up what are called tiered benefit plans, from a platinum plan, which is supposed to pay about 90% of your health care costs, down to a bronze plan, which is supposed to pay about 60% of your health care costs.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who's ever had a major medical incident in their family will know that 60% coverage is not going to save you from bankruptcy and other catastrophes.
Yes.
It basically creates an incentive to move people down the ladder to lower tiered plans and increases inequality.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have the money, you're going to buy a platinum plan. If you, have the, going to get the subsidized benefits from the government, you're going to get a silver plan. And that's a 20% difference in benefit coverage for those who can least afford it. Then on top of that, you have this looming excise tax, which some have called a Cadillac tax.
Oh, yes.
Which is really a Chevy tax. It's taxing decent coverage, and it's going to be implemented in 2017. It really puts a pistol to the heads of unions to cut their benefits or else pay the price through a huge 40% excise tax when you reach these maximums. And right now on the West Coast, there's 20,000 longshoremen who are working without a contract, and one of the issues is that starting in 2017, they got to come up with another $150 million per year to cover the what the cost of an excise tax is.
Wow.
Cut benefits by some amount similar to that. So, you know, you have that whole race to the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, the way that the employer mandate is structured, and again, it's confusing, but, you know, the requirements of which employers have to cover people or pay a penalty and which employees have to be covered, the way it's structured provides an incentive for employers to move their employees down to part-time status and keep them under 30 hours a week, and particularly in sort of low-wage industries, you know, that's happening today. There's a lot of information that hotel workers, fast food workers, their schedules are being manipulated to make sure that they'll never be eligible for coverage. And also adjunct professors are also being impacted by that. I think there's some groups actually in Illinois that I've heard about with that. So you have those tendencies and a tendency of employers to just dump coverage altogether, especially for low-wage workers. And then finally, the union health plans, which are sort of the gold standard of health care coverage for working-class Americans. You know, these are plans that are actually run jointly by unions and their employers. And a lot of workers in the construction industry are covered by these plans, and hospitality industries. They are actually, strangely enough, going to be taxed, and the proceeds of the taxation will be spent to help their competitors in the for-profit insurance industry, to provide subsidies for for-profit insurance industry to cover people in the same kind of conditions that their members are being covered. So it's an additional tax without any mandate that the employers help pay for it, and then it's going to cover the very institutions that are trying to undermine union-based coverage. So it's a real outrage. And again, you know, there will be an incentive, and they are also not covered under any subsidies that are available to these for-profit plans under the insurance exchanges. So a small employer could actually, if they covered their employees through a state exchange plan, could probably get subsidies for a large number of their employees. And if they tried to cover them under the union plan, they'd be excluded. So it's going to create a huge crisis in these plans and undermine decent health care for millions of working Americans and their families.
Well, it sounds like to me the intent of this bill was not to help people with health care, but to expand and entrench the private health insurance industry.
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, they started by bargaining against themselves. They figured the insurance industry was too powerful, so they had to come up with some scheme that didn't undercut their power. And, you know, any shop steward knows that when you bargain against yourself, you're only going to get, you know, less than what you expected, because the other side, as soon as they see that, they see that as a sign of weakness, and they go after you and they undermine it.
I think this has just been a problem with Barack Obama completely ever since he started. Man, he doesn't know how to bargain. He doesn't know how to negotiate. He doesn't want to. He starts where he wants to end up.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not bargaining.
Well, we can get into a big debate about that.
Well, but yeah. Here's
but
the thing.
You got a good point, Bill.
There's somebody I know who's a fairly liberal person and probably a Democrat, and she would say, "Well, you know, he's being a reasonable person." You know, and he's.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, of course, we can get into the whole thing about who actually wrote the Affordable Care Act, which was basically
the Heritage Foundation.
That's going way back, but I'm talking about the recent ACA bill as people from the health insurance industry.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I mean, you know, so just a little, that's kind of sums up what we've currently got. Mark, how would single-payer Medicare for All be better? I mean, how would this be better than what we currently have, like what they have in Canada and Western Europe and a lot of other countries around the world?
Well, you know, ask anybody over 65 how, you know, how Medicare is better. It provides a basic security. It's a birthright. You have it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to think about it. You know, you live in this country, you have health care. And you turn 65, you have Medicare. And that's how it would be for everyone. It
mm-hmm.
would, you know, just create, you know, a basic level of security for everyone in this country about something that just drives all kinds of problems and insecurity for most families. You know,
yes.
It's the biggest cause of bankruptcy is medical costs. You know, people sometimes work for years in jobs that they detest because they're afraid to lose their health care.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just distorts life in a thousand different ways. And every family in America, except maybe for the 1%, has some kind of a story and maybe multiple stories about, you know, the disastrous healthcare system that we live under. So, you know, it would just create, you know, as most of the industrial world has done for decades, you know, a basic level of security for working people that a civilized society ought to maintain.
Well, I know
in
at least
to that, you know, it just controls, you know, the massive cost overruns of this system. It's the most wasteful healthcare system in the world.
Most expensive, yes.
We spend almost twice as much as any other industrialized country in the world for healthcare coverage, and our outcomes are nothing to brag about. You know, we have we rank number 24 in the world in mortality. I think 27th in infant mortality. So, you know, we're not getting great outcomes from a system that costs twice as much as what other people are paying. And,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, moving beyond just the healthcare thing, it's really, this is the answer to all of these austerity attacks on working people. There would be absolutely no federal budget deficit whatsoever if the U.S. spent for healthcare what any other industrialized country spends for healthcare.
That's a good point. So how do you think Medicare for All single payer is going to be achieved in the United States? Because as we know, there's tons of corporate interests that are going to try to prevent it from happening. All their bought and paid for politicians from both parties are going to try to prevent it from happening. And it's going to take, even though the majority of the people polled in the United States consistently over the last, you know, I don't know how many years, support it. How do you think it's going to happen? What do you think it is working people are going to have to do to get healthcare justice in this country?
Well, you know, as you said, you know, this is the reason why we don't have it is because of this is really a fight against corporate power. It's
mm-hmm.
not like we have to come up with any more good ideas. I mean, any healthcare, anybody who looked at the healthcare system understands that if you want to establish healthcare as a right, you want everybody covered at a cost that we can all afford and have equitable benefits, you got to go to some kind of a single payer model. So it's not a question of the best ideas anymore. That's a pretty established. It's a question of, you know, what's blocking healthcare. And, you know, you have to, you know, right now we have a healthcare industry. And it's the biggest, most profitable industry in the history of capitalism. You know, and I used to, when I was in the old oil, chemical, atomic workers, I used to deal with, you know, Union Carbide and Exxon Mobil and Dow Chemical. These are like mom and pop stores compared to the corporate interests surrounding healthcare. And you know, so we really have to build a fight against that kind of corporate power. And that's why labor is so important, because they're about the only one left out there with the capacity and the resources to really mobilize.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when labor jumps into this fight with both feet and full throttle, that's when we're going to begin to win these battles. And that's why we think our job, our mission in the labor campaign for single payer is so important, to really push labor beyond just agreeing that it's a good idea into kind of making this an existential fight for the labor movement.
Mm-hmm. How could people find out more about the labor campaign for single payer?
Well, you can go to our website. It's laborforsinglepayer.org. We're going to have a national strategy conference August 22nd through the 24th in Oakland, California.
And
we'd
mm-hmm.
invite anybody who's got a, you know, a labor connection to come out there. It'll be a real interesting group of folks. There's a lot of stuff happening on the West Coast in terms of healthcare reform and state campaigns. we're going to be jointly meeting with some other single-payer groups for a three-day meeting in Oakland. So if you go to our website, laborforsinglepayer.org, there will be some information on that conference, and I would invite all of your listeners with an interest in labor and health care to think about coming out there.
Well, I'm thinking about coming out there then, because I've got a friend that lives in Oakland, California, so and he's a retired carpenter, and this sounds great. This is good news to hear, Mark. So, Mark, thank you so much for calling in to the World Labor Hour.
Oh, Dave.
Yes, Bill.
I might want to have Mark come back sometime and tell us more about the history of the Labor Party, of which I was a member of for several years.
Yes, indeed. That's an excellent idea, Bill, and also maybe sometime in September we could maybe get a little follow-up from you about what happened out in Oakland, just in case I can't make it.
I'd be glad to do it. I love talking to your folks, so let me know.
Okay. And by the way, this will be available for download on radioforall.net in the future if you want to listen to it.
Okay. Great. Thanks again, Mark.
Thanks. Goodbye. Good talking to you. Bye.
Okay, that was Patti Smith. People have the power. Yes, they do. We just have to get organized and use that power in order to get Medicare for all, health care for everybody, or $15 an hour minimum wage, whatever it is.
Well, don't wait until they take your water away, like in Bolivia, and they're doing, apparently I hear in Detroit.
Oh, yes.
Too.
There's an excellent YouTube video out there. I think it's on YouTube. My wife showed it to me and been sharing it around about the local TV station. Detroit had some reporter on there talking about, these people, they're having problems getting their water shut off because they just don't want to pay their water bills. They'd rather get premium cable and stuff. And there was an elderly black woman who works with some community group, and she went off on this reporter. I mean, it was really good. I mean, it really shocked the newscaster and stuff, but that woman just tore into that guy and just tore his whole
propaganda
apart.
Oh, yeah, and then she probably...
Apart.
took her T-bone steaks and Alaskan king crab legs that she bought with her food stamp card, as Representative Louis Gohmert of Texas calls it, and got into her Cadillac and drove away.
Bill's being facetious here, folks. He's basically making fun of people that say that that's how everybody on food stamps.
Well, everybody always hears about somebody, but nobody's ever actually seen it.
That's a good point.
You know.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on
We might mention one thing before we leave, a public service announcement.
Oh, yes, we didn't do any public service announcements. Go ahead, Bob.
There's supposed to be a music festival downtown Champaign tonight put on by the Champaign Park District, Mary Poza Music Festival, and WEFT is supposed to have our table and tent out there and handing out information and stuff like that, so it starts at 6, but... you know, that's all based on the weather. I know that there's a flash flood warning in effect here until about 3 p.m. this afternoon.
Get this, man. When I was coming into town,